Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Bill West, Jonathan Bombouli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy?
Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' all-time hockey!
If it feels like a while, that's because it has been a while. Penguins Roundtable back at you on a Friday, our normal slot 1 to 2. Ken Laird, joined by Jonathan Bombouli, Trib Total Media Penguins beat writer extraordinaire, who's back over from the Cranberry Complex. Hustled over here to get here in time. How are you, JB?
Yeah, with about 30 seconds to spare. Good timing, huh?
And you sent Bill West off to Canada, huh? Good on you.
Well, actually, that Montreal trip, I think we were probably fighting each other for that one. That's a, it's a nice that road is. City to visit, yeah.
That is a luxurious one. We'll have just a square table then today, the two of us, to break down what's happened here over the last couple of weeks, and a lot to get to. But let's start with a bit of breaking news. You know the Wilkes-Barre team so well from recent years out there, and it looks like we've flip-flopped some Wilkes-Barre guys, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. Connor Sheary and Scott Wilson down, and Tom Kuhnhackl and Brian Rust up. You know, talking to Mike Sullivan about that today, it seemed like the main point he was hitting was that from Wilson and Sheary's perspective, like, this is part of the process. You come up, you have that adrenaline rush, you have a couple of good games early. Sheary had 2 points in his second game against Boston. Wilson, in his first game up, had an assist and had that fight with Boone Jenner after he hit Malkin knee on knee. He had, like, 3 hits in that game. So they both had, you know, really big games right when they came up, and then, you know, the adrenaline wears off and pretty soon you're, you know, playing 8 minutes and not making much of an impact, and it's time to go down, and it's time for somebody else to come up in your place. So that's what we've seen here in the last couple of days.
Which is amazing. I mean, Sheary was, God, Sullivan was gushing about him right out of the gate, right? So was he surprised he hit a wall, or do you think Sullivan even expected this? He was going to get a short-term burst out of him and have to move on.
I think he probably was surprised, you know, to a certain extent in that, I mean, you always hope that the guy you call up is going to be the one who claims a job and keeps it. But, I mean, we've seen this a lot. You know, this is probably, you know, 90% of the cases, guys don't come up and stick immediately. I talked to a couple of guys about that today. Nick Bonino, he was in the Anaheim organization, and he got called up and sent down a few times before he finally stuck. And Brian Dumoulin, who did the same here. And they both talked about how, for a young player, consistency is just so difficult to find. And Dumoulin was talking about how, and this is probably more magnified for a defenseman than it is for a forward, but he talked about how when you're playing in the minors, you can have a bad game. And if you're playing against a team that doesn't have a lot of high-end skill, you can sort of get away with it. And it can look to the outside like you played a good game. You come up here and you have a bad game, and everyone's going to know, and you're going to look bad because every team has the kind of skill to really, you know, take you to task.
So now Kevin Porter has stayed. Now, why has he avoided the send down?
I'll tell you this. I like what Kevin Porter does. I know some people don't. Here's the situation. After Pascal Dupuis retired, in quotes, the Penguins were down to 3 forwards who can kill penalties. It was Fair and Bonino and Cullen, and that's it. So if you don't call somebody up for that role, you're playing your superstars in that spot. Some teams like to do that. Some teams don't. I'm not a big fan of it personally. So are you going to put, you know, Chris Kunitz in that spot? Are you going to put Sergei Plotnikov in that spot? I'd rather have Kevin Porter there, who's actually pretty good at it. And I'll tell you this. You know, he's played, I don't know, 30-some minutes of shorthanded ice time so far since he's been up. And the Penguins haven't given up a single power play goal when he's been on the ice during that time.
Yeah, the results are hard to argue with, aren't they? What are they, at 20 straight kills or something at this point?
Yeah, exactly.
PK?
So, you know, you look at him, even strength, and, you know, you see not a lot of production. Well, certainly very little production. But even, you know, if a puck rolls off his stick and people are like, oh, send that guy down. Yeah, no. Porter's doing his job. And, you know, Sheary and Wilson, absolutely. I mean, those guys, you want them to bring a spark. You want them to provide energy. You want them to get pucks to the net. They weren't doing that the last couple of games. So shuffle them down, no question about it. But Porter, he's doing exactly what they're asking him to do.
Okay. And they had tried Scott Wilson in the playoffs last year, very famously, as we remember. Yes. Now, give me the update on the new guys then. What does Tom Kuhnhackl bring, or what are they hoping from Brian Rust again? We've seen this movie before.
Yeah, I mean, there's no surprises out of Brian Rust. What he is got good speed. He's an energy line guy. They'll want him to, you know, get in on the forecheck. And that's actually a little bit more important under Sullivan than it was under Mike Johnston, because he encourages, you know, not like, you know, 90s style dump and chase hockey, but he encourages more dump ins than Johnston did.
Yeah.
Just to avoid turnovers. Sullivan preaches avoiding turnovers in bad areas of the ice.
It drives him nuts, doesn't it?
The other
game, he was talking about that, where, you know, we have a lot of skill guys, but if we make poor decisions at the blue lines, we're going to be in trouble.
Right, and those gray areas, like at both blue lines, generally is what you're talking about.
Yep.
You turn pucks over there, and it drives coaches crazy. It drives him especially crazy. So, in response to that, when you get to those areas, and you know, you can't carry the puck in, because in 2016 everybody wants to carry the puck in, everybody wants to possess the puck, I understand that, but when you reach a point where you can't do that, where your options are try to beat two guys by yourself or dump it in, you dump it in. And that happens more under Sullivan than it did under Johnston, and that is Brian Rust's sort of specialty. Go in there and use his speed and get a hit and possess the puck that way.
Well, they're in the lineup per today's combinations, right? They're both on the line with Bonino, so that's your third line.
It looks that way.
In the meantime, the Penguins' Russian signing from the offseason, Politnikov, as Rutherford calls him, is out. These guys are up on ahead of him. You just played against the Chicago team whose Russian signing is the rookie of the year in the league and just scorched them for, what, 8 goals? How many did Panarin score against them in those 2 games?
All of them.
So is this a roster disaster, what we're witnessing here, JB? Is just my ultimate over. Like, what should Jim Rutherford think about this?
About
he's got AHLers in, he's got him out, Plotnikov sucks, he's being pulled out of the lineup. You know, you're looking at the Hawks and the way they were able to glean talent from Russia, and you weren't able to.
Well, I'll tell you this. There were, you know, I was looking at this list. I haven't really done all the legwork on it yet, but it's something that I'll write about coming up here soon, you know, on the blog, if nothing else, but maybe a full-blown story about it.
Don't minimize the blog. The blog is your heavy hitter. You posted a Michelle Terry in 2005 rant there that has to be the highest rated .com posting of the last year.
It should be. I also, that's where I had the big list of players, the Kevin Porter list, about players who have had the most shorthanded ice time in the NHL this year without being on the ice for a power play goal against. I had like a long list of like the top 10 guys or whatever.
Beautiful.
Porter told me today that he saw the list and he's rooting for the guy ahead of him to give up a power play goal so he can be at the top of the list.
He's got a voodoo pincushion of the guy in his locker. Nice.
Yeah, right, exactly. Brendan Dillon actually is his name, defenseman from San Jose, just for the record. But anyway, what I was going to write about, and I will at some point, is every year there's a number of these undrafted European free agents that hit the market, and teams go out and they sign them. So last year, Panarin was the jewel of that crop, but people were also excited about Viktor Tikhonov and Sergei Plotnikov. And also a guy named Steve Moses, who's a Canadian guy who had a huge year in the KHL. So Panarin signs with the Blackhawks and is awesome. You know, plays on Patrick Kane's line and is the favorite to win Rookie of the Year. Tikhonov also signed with Chicago, did nothing, got waived, and then got claimed by Arizona. Plotnikov signs with the Penguins, has done little. Offensively, he's done nothing. He's done some things with possession that makes you think that maybe there's something there, but... you know, not a ton. This Moses guy signed with Nashville, didn't make the NHL roster, went down to the minors, got waived, and went back to Europe. Like, it's a tough market to hit home runs in.
Quit making excuses for Rutherford. Why didn't they get Panarin?
You know what? There's 29 NHL GMs who are kicking themselves right now for not going out and getting Panarin. He didn't get that big a contract.
Less than Plotnikov, right?
Right. I mean, you would if you offered him, you know, $1.5 million, you probably could have had him. So in that respect, yes, you're right. You know, Rutherford should have got him, and 28 other guys should have went harder after him. But it's a crapshoot scouting wise. You don't know who's going to be Panarin and who's going to be Plotnikov. I mean, you know,
and have they given up on Plotnikov, or is it just too soon? I mean, maybe that's not fair to the guy, but I haven't seen much here.
Well,
I mean,
Sullivan said that he thinks to get, you know, to and I think this is really true, for Plotnikov to, you know, create some offense, which you're going to need him to do at some point. I mean, I like the fact that he drives possession. I like the fact that he's a bull from the dots on down. Below the goal line, you know, he's tough to move off the puck. Yep. But at some point, you got to produce something. So, and Sullivan said the way he thinks that could happen is if he sort of patterned himself after Patrick Hornquist's game more, which would be in the sense of, well, as good as Plotnikov is below the dots and as strong as he is on his skates, he doesn't really go to the front of the net very often. And you know, the goals he scored in the preseason were kind of like skill player goals, playing on the line with Malkin. So he needs to score some off his shin pads and on tips and rebounds and deflections and just stuffing them in.
Do you think because the offseason was the Kessel offseason, we added a skill guy, we needed to add a plot that, like, they thought, let's go get Hornquist part two. They tactically went after Plotnikov to be a net front guy.
I think it was just, and I know Tom Fitzgerald was involved in the European scouting last year with the, in terms of, like, that's how they drafted Dominic Simone.
Yeah.
I think it was just exploring other avenues for getting players. When you've traded away all your draft picks like the Penguins have in the last however many years, you have to explore other ways to bring in prospects.
Right.
And I think that was the driving force more than it was, let's go get a big body guy. Like, I think they would have taken, the style of play wasn't important. They wanted to go get a European guy who they thought might develop into a top six or top nine role, and they picked the wrong guy. Or they weren't able to get the guy that they wanted. I mean, you know, Panarin, this is not communist Russia. He did have a choice.
Well, it's close.
He chose to go to Chicago, and as it turns out, he seems like he made the right choice, right? I mean, there's a lot of NHL coaches that wouldn't have given him a second-line spot with Patrick Kane on the other wing, and Quenneville did, so good on him.
Yeah, and there was a story in the Chicago Tribune, I mean, for full disclosure, that I read that talked about a coach or a guy in the Chicago organization who had coached in St. Petersburg on the very team that Plotnikov played for, so he knew the landscape very well and had some connections. But I think the frustration for Pens fans is, you know, you've got Malkin. You got one of the premier Russian players on the planet. Can't you parlay that into, let's convince Panarin to come here and play with me?
Sure. Yeah. Or, you know, Washington could play that same card.
Yeah.
You know, or St. Louis with Tarasenko. I mean, you know, there's, yeah, should a team that was looking for a European winger, should it have targeted Panarin ahead of Plotnikov? Well, with hindsight, I mean.
Yeah, it just stares you in the face, especially this morning when Plotnikov's just been benched for Tom Kuhnhackl. So, you know.
Well, he's German. Is that exciting?
There you go. Yes, they combed the earth for Kuhnhackl.
Yeah, right.
We're talking probably a little bit too much about the bottom six. I actually, just to reset here over the last couple weeks, JB, I mean, there have been some times I've felt really good about the team watching them. They showed some signs of life. I know you were bullish on a few weeks back we would see a difference. It took a little longer, I think, than everybody that was feeling that way thought to materialize after the 0-4 start, but the Detroit game, the Islanders game, the first Chicago game, was this what you kind of were expecting in the Sullivan tweak, the change?
Yeah,
the coach?
Exactly. And when I was bullish, when I was making those predictions, I said that they would come out, the Penguins would come out in the two games against Carolina and Columbus, and they would score 10 goals. That's what I said. And I was wrong, and I'm owning up to that. But within a span of two games after that, they had the stretch against Detroit and the Islanders. Where they scored 10 goals. So I was just a little ahead of the time frame on it. But yeah, I mean, that Detroit and Islanders games, that's the good stuff. I mean, and those are two pretty decent teams, incidentally. And playoff teams at any rate. And the Detroit game was the back end of a back-to-back, which is an issue that's been giving this team some problems lately.
Right.
So those are, you know, and the first Chicago game was fine. I mean, you know, that's obviously a step up in competition even from Detroit and the Islanders. But, yeah man.
That's impressive for you to come back out of 2-0 deficits twice. We never saw that under Mike Johnston.
Well, yeah,
that
right.
Ability.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the lack of third period comebacks and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think I've been sort of trying to, you know, get my head around the idea of what do you make of these two Chicago games? Especially the second Chicago game where they got beat really badly. And do you say, you know, the Detroit and Islanders games were a, you know, figment of your imagination, and that they're back to sort of slugging it out? Do you say that there's a certain level of competition that they're going to get to, and then that's when they're going to run into problems? Like when they're only playing, when they're playing against the real elite teams, they're going to, you know, struggle, except against everyone else, they're going to be okay? Or is it just sort of a, and I think I might be leaning toward this right now, they were playing, you know, the second half of a back-to-back on the road against one of the three best teams in the league.
But the back-to-back goes out because you just played that same team the night before.
True, but that's the Penguins are on the road for this second half of the back-to-back. Chicago comes out, has a good first period, and there's a lot of energy in that building, and it helps.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm not making excuses. They got destroyed in that game. I mean,
was humbling. It was embarrassing.
Yeah. It was a really bad beating, and it was. But you know what? Another thing I look at is I was trying to make some sense of who this team beats and who they lose to. So I was looking at, like, what's their record against playoff teams? What's their record against non-playoff teams? What's their record against teams that have better than 50 points in the standings? What's their record against division leaders?
Yeah.
And I'm looking at them, and I have this paper right in front of me with lots of records and things scrawled on it, and there is no pattern whatsoever. You can't figure it out. I mean, there's...
I think that, here's my point before you read these, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I'm not going to.
My feeling is this team, when they play... And they got all their parts, and they're playing well, and they're engaged. They're as good as anybody in the league. But they're so soft mentally. If they get pushed on a back-to-back night or things don't go well, and they often don't come out of the gates well, it's just a sign of their overall team fragility, which I think will show up in those numbers that you're talking about.
Well,
and Sullivan's got to change that. And it's not going to be overnight that he can do it, but I think he's got to be aware of it.
That's true, and Malkin was actually talking about that today, about first periods, because that was... obviously, in that Chicago game, I mean, they got beat all night, but they got beat really bad in the first period.
Was it the worst period of the year, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably. But that, you know, when I'm sitting there, I'm not thinking there were certain periods near the end of the Johnston era where you're like, this is just broken. When I was watching the first period of that game in Chicago, my thought wasn't this is broken. My thought was, holy cow, this one team is a lot better than this other team.
Yeah.
So there's an element of Chicago being good thrown into that.
But, well, that's true. But you got Crosby and Malkin and Kessel, and it's like, I mean, I hear you. I mean, Chicago's great, but you're supposed to be Chicago. You know, it's like,
sure.
It's not like you're in rebuild mode. This is your team, and you're pretty healthy right now.
And, I mean, the bottom line is when you have a home and home with the Blackhawks, you got to be, the goal has to be get 2 points out of it, right?
Yep.
And they got one. So, you know. That maybe a puck going in 3-on-3 the previous night, the home game, might change your outlook on things a little bit.
And if Fleury doesn't play as well, though, on Wednesday night, you know, you might lose 7-1 because that was one of the premier performances I've seen in Fleury's career. He was unbelievable.
Unreal.
That night.
I mean, and not just like making just the save on Van Riemsdyk with the knob of his stick.
Wow. Yeah.
That was just like, that was beyond, like, you know, athleticism and talent. That was just like, I don't even know what. It was like magical.
After a save on Kane at the post, like, you know, he was ticketed top corner. He gets the shoulder up. I mean, he was just so not only in control, but dazzling saves on top of it.
Yep. Yeah, great game from him.
It really was.
But let me tell you just a couple things.
Well, give me some of the numbers.
Out of this exercise. Well, I mean, the numbers aren't, you know, against playoff teams, 10-10-2. Against non-playoff teams, 9-6-3. So they're a little better against non-playoff teams, like, which is pretty much what you'd expect out of any team, right?
Right.
There's nothing out of the ordinary there. And you look at, like, good wins. They have good wins. That Washington...
Montreal. I called the Montreal win signature, and that blew up in my face.
It did, but in fairness to you, Montreal had the best record in the conference at that point, and they were down in the third period, and they came back and beat them. That Washington win a couple weeks before that, nobody beats Washington anymore. Especially in Washington.
And they were there, yep.
Yeah, and they were losing in the third period, and they came back and won that game. The Detroit win is a good win. They have a win over Florida, and Florida doesn't lose to anybody right now. They beat St. Louis. Minnesota's a really good team. They beat them twice. So there's good wins, and then there's just atrocious losses. There's Carolina, and there's Calgary, and there's Winnipeg, and there's, you know, the first Columbus game. So I can't find a...
Which might have got Johnston fired, right? What was the nail in the coffin game? Was that the Columbus game, or was that
It was the Jersey game right after the Columbus game. Yeah. But and Jersey's a playoff team right now.
Yep.
So, but if you break it down like this, against the elite teams in the Eastern Conference, so I'm going to say those are the six non-wild card teams, right?
Okay.
Florida, Detroit, Montreal, Washington, the Islanders, and Rangers. Those are the six that are at the top of the standings.
That's fair.
The Penguins are 5-2. So, I mean, that's really good. Then you look at the two wild card teams right now, New Jersey and Boston, 0-3. So there's no pattern there.
Boston games are a little bit understandable to me because you had just fired the coach.
Sure.
Your roster was in disarray. Wasn't Crosby out for one of those two? I mean, at least Letang was out for sure.
Yeah. I don't remember which game was the one. No, Crosby missed the Columbus game.
Okay.
That they won.
Yeah.
My point is that there's the – when coaches and players all the time say, you know, when you talk to them about, like when I asked Sullivan after that bad loss in Chicago, I said, all right, you played back-to-back nights against a really good team. You had a good effort and an overtime loss in the first game. You had just a bad beating in the second game. What does that say about where your team is right now? And he just couldn't be any less interested in answering that question.
Yeah, he shot you down. I heard that.
Yeah. He was just like, yeah, you know, I'm not really thinking about that. And what he talks about is, you know, we have to focus on ourselves. We have to focus on playing the right way. This sort of breakdown of who they beat and who they lose to, it really reinforces that idea that he needs to be, you know, talking about with this team. Like, I mean, of course you do your pre-scout and you find out what your opponents do on the power play, what they do on their penalty kill, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But the real answer as to how the Penguins are playing is in the Penguins locker room.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. Letang, first and foremost, now, he has been at the heart of a lot of good and bad here over the last couple games. He was named to the All-Star squad over Crosby. We'll get to that in a bit. But the record without him and with him in the lineup now. It's really mind-blowing, and that being said, a minus 15 or something when he went out, and so he was getting bashed, like people were saying, I'm glad he's gone, you know, good, I mean, they're not going to miss anything. Here we go, you know, some of these games he's had bad penalties, like mind-numbingly dumb Letang-esque penalties, and then he's come back and sparked them to win, so how important has he been here of late to them?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. I don't have them in front of me, but it's you know, staggering. They're like 1-7-1 when he doesn't play or something like that.
They are. I think they're 18-9-4 or something with him.
Yeah, and that goes to show you that, well, it has something to do with, you know, the playing time he gets, obviously. I mean, when you're trying to replace a 27-minute defenseman, it's difficult.
Yep.
Anytime. And I just, when I come to Letang and I look at what he's done under Sullivan, and it's, you know, I mean, his offensive numbers are tremendous under Sullivan. I feel like Sullivan, and this may be too much amateur psychology, and if it is, I apologize, but I feel like he really pushes the right buttons with Letang. Like, anytime, I wrote this, anytime he publicly talks about Letang, he starts out with, this guy is one of the elite, world-class, talented defensemen in the league.
And then
builds him up. And then follows it up with, but here's what he needs to, you know, here's where he does things wrong. And it's, tries to do too much, turns the puck over at the offensive blue line, generally.
Yeah.
And to me, that, you know, carrot and stick in the same paragraph, like, that seems like such a really sound way to try to motivate a star player. So, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit. Maybe it's just a matter of Letang feeling healthy. Yeah, and I'm sure that has something to do with it. I mean,
well, he's figured in on 9 of their last 13 goals. You know, some of those have been on the power play. So sometimes, you know, that gets, you know, you get a assist in there maybe that doesn't deserve. But I go back to the first Chicago game, the Crosby goal off the rush. Letang comes out of his zone. He dusts Patrick Kane. He blew through another guy in the neutral zone. And now they're off, right? Now David Perron can actually do something useful.
Mm-hmm.
He's got some space. He drops it to Sid. He buries it. It was like, that is Chris Letang at his best right there.
Sure, and near the end under Johnston, Letang was facing so much opposition in the neutral zone, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that breakout was slow to develop. And I mean, I understand the logic and the rationale behind it. About having four guys, you know, working together. It sounds great. It worked for Finland. And that's fine.
Looks good in a book.
It looks good in a book. But what it ends up happening is your four-man offensive pack coming out of the defensive zone runs into a four-man defensive pack in the neutral zone, and now all of a sudden Chris Letang's trying to navigate, you know.
Yeah, he's water-skiing through sludge.
Yeah, 16 skates and 8 sticks he has to get pucks through.
Yeah.
Now, with Sullivan's sort of more sudden breakout approach, he might have to beat one guy, you know, which he does routinely. So it's a better fit for him. It's a better fit for Crosby in exactly the same way. Crosby's not having to work as hard in the neutral zone. So
yeah, it's a better watch.
Yeah.
And I wonder, and I want to ask you about Crosby too here, because he has seemed like a different player since he took a week off. I don't know if that's health related. I don't know if you've been able to glean whether he just kind of needed to clear his head, or is there something to he had quit under Johnston and the new system, he's back. At least in the short term, he's buying in, he's believing.
Well, I don't think he quit under Johnston. I think he kept running into that wall we were just talking about, you know, in various ways where things were more difficult for him than they should be. And it's just tough to fight through that every single night. Some nights he did, you know. Other nights he didn't. And there's just less sort of a headwind, I feel like, with the way Sullivan has this team playing. So and hey, 6 days off is 6 days off, too. I mean, I wrote today the stat about the team, and I think it applies to Crosby as much as anyone. This team is 5-1 when they have 3 or more days off before games. So maybe that has something to do with age. I mean, they are an older team. But
age and fragility.
Right. But also just, I mean, this is like Captain Obvious comment here, but Crosby's game is when he's got fresh legs, that's when his game is at its best. So, you know, get a couple days off before a game, and all of a sudden Crosby has a huge game like he had in Minnesota coming off the Christmas break. You know, that's, to me, the perfect example of it. So I'm all – and you know, when I asked Sullivan about that recently, about making sure Crosby, you know, gets his rest. And he basically turned it into a discussion about, you know, the whole team and when do you practice and when do you give them the day off and that sort of thing. I think that's fine. But I would be willing to bet that, you know, in terms of this All-Star break, that Mike Sullivan somewhere is smiling that Sidney Crosby's not going to Nashville. Because that's 5 days off. When he comes back, he'll be shot out of a cannon.
31 points in 39 games for Sid. It's not a normal year for him in terms of that. But of late, you can just see it, right? He's got, 6 goals in his last 6 games or 7 games?
Right, he had a 4-game goal scoring streak, and
first time since 2010, right?
Right, but also that goal against Chicago on the power play that was credited to Malkin. I'm not 100% sure Sid didn't tip that. It sure looked like he might have.
So it was a blast by Malkin. I mean, he deserves credit for it somehow. But yeah. Maybe it was a Sid tip.
If he did tip it, then you're looking at, you know, career long goal scoring streaks. So
that's, you know, what's weird about that. We have seen a lot in the league this year where it'll take them 4 days and they'll make a scoring change.
Yeah.
Why are they so slow on that?
I don't know. I mean, that's a real like political hand grenade. Like, you know, if you're in the locker room and you think you may have got a tip there, do you go make a big stink out of it? Your teammate take a goal away from a teammate, and then you sound like a jerk. So that's always been a. There are some guys who are, you know, that I've covered over the years in the minors who are just vigilant about it. Yeah. Like they would, if somebody forgot a second assist that they got, they will like, you know, storm into the official scorer's booth and say, "Hey, where's my second assist?" So,
well, that's money on the line.
Yeah, but you don't want to be known as that guy. You know, it's a difficult thing to balance.
It's the Pens Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio. You're listening to Jonathan Bomboli, Penguins beat reporter. I'm Ken Laird. We're brought to you by the Team Spanos Group of Raymond James, the face of financial guidance in Pittsburgh. We'll talk more about Sid coming up, including his all-star snub, if I can say it right, and the guys that did make it, the format. As Jonathan was talking about, maybe it's a blessing in disguise. You get a couple of days off here. Also, take a peek at how the rest of the line combinations have sifted through. Defensive pairings now that Letang is back, and Fleury back off his absence. Much to get to here on the roundtable. You're welcome to email. We'd love your thoughts and your questions for Jonathan. SportsTalk@TribWeb.com. To email SportsTalk@TribWeb.com. Back in a minute.
Geist, pursuing justice for real people. Online at GoodrichandGeist.com. Injured? Do you have a case? Call Goodrich & Geist at 412-766-1455. Goodrich & Geist, located at 3634 California Avenue in Pittsburgh's North Side. Goodrich & Geist, attorneys at law, online at goodrichandgeist.com. All playoff coverage brought to you by Goodrich & Geist, investing in the community with roots in Pittsburgh.
$5 for breakfast, $10 for lunch, $15 for dinner. You're eating, but you're not eating gourmet food for those prices. If you work for 30 years and then are retired for 30 years, you're going to need $10,900 a year just to eat at those prices. That's not factoring in inflation or taxes. That would be $327,000 just to eat in your retirement years without inflation, and another $327,000 to feed your spouse or significant other. In other words, if you're now questioning if you've saved enough to eat in retirement, call the financial advisors of the Spanos Group of Raymond James, 866-916-RETIRE, to develop a written financial goal plan tailored to your resources and financial goals. Spanos Group, Pittsburgh Magazine's face of financial guidance. That number again, 866-916-RETIRE. Raymond James & Associates, Inc., member New York Stock Exchange, SIPC.
Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Bill West,
Jonathan Bombouli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' all-time hockey!
Jonathan Bombouli has been covering hockey since he was born. Literally. Now, how many years has it been, JB? You've been on the
99.
Hockey circuit for a while.
99 was my first year.
That 16 years then we going with? 17?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that range. That's a good long time. Mm-hmm. And his expertise comes out on this show. We love having you here. The Pens Roundtable every Friday from 1 to 2.
I thought you were going somewhere with that. You were just paying me a compliment. How nice.
There was no cheap shot coming there. There was no hitting the numbers to send you up against the wall there.
I thought you were going to call me old or something. I don't know.
We take questions for JB here on the show. Ben gives his observations, Jonathan. He says, in my opinion, on paper, this team looks pretty good. If anything, they need maybe a top four defenseman to be a legit contender. But my question to you is, how can you explain the lack of production for guys like Perron, Hornquist, Bonino, Fair, Kunitz, maybe even Kessel, as compared to their career stats?
Yeah. Good, I don't know. And that, to me, that's the thing. People talk about the need for a top four defenseman, and I don't necessarily disagree with that. But to me, the biggest need on this team right now is some production on the wings. And, you know, I mean, and Bill West wrote a story in today's paper about Hornquist and how, like, his shooting percentage is nowhere near what it has been in previous years. So you'd think a guy like that would pick up the production a little bit. And there's no way Perron's numbers can stay like this, considering the shots and scoring chances he's had. So, okay, so that's one thing you need is some regression or progression to the mean from guys like Perron and Hornquist. Kessel is sort of what Kessel is. I mean, he's a little below his career numbers, but just slightly, so he'll probably score a couple more goals and that'll even out. But so the one thing is more production from Perron and Hornquist. And then to me, I think you might need a left-handed shooting scoring winger, like a left wing, more than you need a top four defenseman. I don't see anybody on that who can really, on this roster, who really fits that well on the left side, who's a left shot, to play with Crosby or Malkin.
Because Kunitz is Cullen and Sheary played over there of late,
right? They tried Sheary, they tried Cullen. I mean, Kunitz at this stage in his career is not a top six left wing, not in a scoring line capacity anyway. By the way, I think Kunitz is still a valuable player on an NHL roster, just not in that role for that salary. Hornquist, you can try him on the left wing, and they did today at practice. Sullivan had him on the left wing with Malkin and Kessel instead of Cullen there. So, you know, that maybe beefs up that line a little bit. But he's right-handed and much prefers playing on the right side. So I'm starting to question the conventional wisdom that the number one need is a top 4D. And I'm starting to think the number one need is a left-handed shooting scoring winger.
David Perron has one goal in 21 games. Yeah. One goal in 21 games.
And just, I mean, a boatload of chances. You know, it's not like he's disappeared. He's just
16
not,
games without a goal.
Yeah, that's stunning. It really is. I mean, and his track record is not that. And it's not, you know, I mean, there were times where this was like a real lackluster, lifeless offensive attack under Mike Johnston. You haven't seen that under Mike Sullivan.
Yeah.
You know, and still.
And I know he's playing the right side, so that doesn't go to your left wing problem, but it's just to the winger problem, you know.
Right. And he could be one of your top two left wing, you know, top six left wings if he gets any kind of production together. He does like to play on the right side, so.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying a winger for the left side.
Well, one guy that I really like, I don't know if the Bruins are going to fall out of it, but he's a free agent at the end of the year, Louis Erickson, who they traded in the Sagan deal. Bruins have been in trouble here of late because they lost David Krejci and they lost Brad Marchand to suspension. But one thing about this league that I've noticed, Jonathan, watching it, it's like the parity shows up. If you lose a player, we've seen it with Letang, a player or two, you just can't overcome it. I mean, look at the Canadiens without Price and Brendan Gallagher.
Yeah.
Then they get Brendan Gallagher back in, and they're playing a lot better. I mean, it really makes a difference in this league. So as good as Boston looked a couple weeks ago, they're struggling right now. If they fade out of it, and they look to I look at like a Louis Erickson, somebody like that you can bring in. If you can fit them under the cap, I don't know what their situation is and you know what you'd have to give up to get them, but it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I haven't. I'll have to do that. I'll have to look and see who are the, you know, what wingers are pending UFAs.
For instance, Columbus has made a big deal with Johansson and Seth Jones. Now that's more of a you know trade for trade, you know, change of scenery guys, I guess. But we're starting to see some trade movement in the league, obviously.
Yeah, that was a fascinating trade in the sense that like you just don't see those anymore.
Yeah.
Those one for one.
One for one, yeah.
Yeah, potentially star for star. Those guys, that's like young star for young star. And you know what's so cool about that is, like, it makes perfect sense. I mean, Nashville needed a center and Columbus needed a D, and it makes so much sense, and yet you never see deals like that. That one was exciting, I thought. And I also thought it was exciting that somebody, I can't believe somebody took Vinny LeCavalier's contract on. I thought.
Oh, did Philly get bailed out there? That's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I know they ate some of the money, but geez. I mean, and you know what? I mean, L.A.'s playing great, and he might fit right in there, and it might be, you know, gangbusters, but I just think
he's done.
Yeah, I think Ron Hextall did. Getting that salary off his books, that's like he gets a gold star for that one.
Yeah, how many get-out-of-jail-free cards can Philly have? I mean, with the Pronger situation and everything, these guys that retire and somehow they get their money just to, you know, they make mistakes and it goes away.
Well, they have more dead money on their cap than most teams because they have to swallow, you know, some of LeCavalier and some of Shen and some of, there's others. I don't know that they're swallowing any of Pronger at this point. That might be past, but they do have that dead money, which is not an ideal situation.
One bit of optimism has been Hornquist, though, for me, Jonathan. He's looked like a different guy of late, too, especially that Detroit game. Wow, was he good in that one.
Yeah, and his like scoring chances went way up just in the Sullivan era.
Yep.
So, but the thing about Hornquist is, I mean, he's going to be that net front guy in your power play, on the first power play unit. That's his, you know, that's his thing, man. That's his bread and butter. They still haven't been able to get him to a spot 5-on-5 where he can really create and be comfortable. Because, you know, now you got him on the left side, which he's not that comfortable with. But he's playing with Malkin and Kessel, so, you know, that might work out in terms of creativity. I don't think Hornquist's game and Crosby's game, I know they had some success together in the past, but I don't think their games really mesh all that well. Because Hornquist goes to the front of the net, like, religiously. And Crosby likes somebody to be behind the net with him, so that they can work together behind the net. And it seems
cycle
like
it up a bit, yeah.
Cycle a bit, yeah. And I feel like when I see Crosby playing with Hornquist, I feel like Crosby's back behind the net by himself. Hornquist is in front of the net by himself, and Crosby's like, "Hey, a little help back here," and he doesn't get it. So I don't. Maybe I'm misreading that. I mean, I haven't seen them play that many games together, to be honest with you. There are people who have seen them play together a lot more than I have. But I don't know that that's, I mean, I really, Hornquist might, if you, this, the ideal lineup for this team really might have Hornquist on the third line, even strength, but on the first power play unit. I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea.
Did it look like today all signs were pointing toward Hornquist with Gino and Kessel tomorrow night?
Yep, Hornquist on the left side. Kunitz, Crosby, and Perron left alone. And the Bonino with the new kids on his wings. Kunitz on the left and Rust on the right. Plotnikov was, you know, we had him dead and buried, but he was rotating in on that line. And Sullivan could very, like, he wasn't. He could very easily change his mind and play Plotnikov in place of Kunitz or Rust tomorrow if he wanted to. And then Porter, Cullen, Fair in your the most that might be one of the more boring lines in hockey, but you know, that's what they need out of those three guys is go kill penalties and get pucks deep. And that's your, you know, I would consider, I don't know if you consider that a fourth line or you consider that the third line and the one with the kids on at the fourth. But regardless, and getting back to the emailer's point, I really think that those bottom six guys, for as valuable as they've been killing penalties, I think they do. There needs to be some more production there. You need to see an occasional goal out of a Bonino or a Fair, especially.
Yeah.
You know, Porter doesn't score. You don't really expect it. But, yeah, you need him to chip in, too. And if guys like Sheary and Wilson come up and they're not doing it, well, now who's scoring other than Crosby and Malkin?
The difference in this league, teams that have a top nine that can score versus teams that are, you know, one line and that's it, or two at best, you know what I mean? You can see Chicago's got that, right? I mean, they get Tara Vinen on a third line and Desjardins scoring for them, and I don't know.
Well, that's why I sort of think that left wing is a priority. Because if you add a left wing to this group, you can get a nine together that you like, especially, yep, like, say, a third line of Kunitz, Bonino, and Hornquist. You could work with that.
Yes.
You know? So, or even, you know, Fair in could get thrown into that mix because he's a guy who scored at some point in his career. But yeah, you're right. That I really feel like ever since Crosby started to, you know, pick it back up, which was a little bit before Christmas, but, you know, primarily after Christmas, I feel like the contributions from the secondary scorers have been like, have completely disappeared once Crosby heated up. So,
which is good. I mean, we're complaining that the Stars weren't scoring, but now you're the other way, you know. Okay, here we go. But now
it's like it's whack-a-mole. It's
exactly what it is.
You whack the one problem of Crosby not scoring, and then the other problem of the bottom six not scoring pops up.
I could see Mike Sullivan being a pretty good whack-a-mole player, so maybe he'll get the job done.
I could imagine he'd be fierce, I tell you that much. He wouldn't, you know, all you really have to do is tap the mole to record the point. But I think he'd give it a good shot, you know.
He'd break the thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Absolutely.
Has he changed at all to you covering him here as opposed to you covering him in the AHL, or has he been the same guy?
You know, I was talking to some guys who, I mean, just from my experience with him, like, you know, in rookie camp and in real limited capacity before this year, I haven't seen a lot of difference. But I talked to some guys, some scouts who knew him when he was just breaking in Providence like 10 years ago when he was just retired and he was a rookie coach, even before he coached the Bruins. And they said he was very abrasive then. Hmm. Like the players were, you know, he wore out his welcome quickly. And I think that's the one area that over the years where he's evolved is that he's still, you know, I mean, he still runs that risk. But I think he's learned that you have to have that personal relationship with players before you can start just, you know, teeing off on them. If you walk in the first day and you just tell somebody why they stink, that's going to be, you're going to have an adversarial relationship the whole time. You have to sort of get that bond before, then you can tell them they stink.
Any sense of whether he and his assistants are getting along better than Johnston and talking to the boys seem to?
You know, I've been meaning to sort of explore that angle and I haven't done that yet is talking to Tockett and Martin about their role. In practice, it seems to be you'll have Martin will come in and Sullivan will bring him in to explain a drill or two, you know, when they're doing a series of drills in practice. And Tockett's doing a lot of grunt work right now, doing a lot of pre-scouting and, you know, getting tendencies of opponents' power plays and stuff like that. So it seems to be, I mean, just, you know, from a real sort of, you know, just surface level, it looks like they've found their roles. But I'd like to look into that a little bit more going forward.
Back to the mail we go here on the Pens Roundtable, brought to you by the Team Spanos Group of Raymond James. Carl asks, any chance the Penguins get Jonathan Drouin?
He's left-handed, isn't he?
I don't know, but
I think he is. Yeah, he might
he's,
be. That
he's shown some talent, right?
Yeah, I don't. I haven't heard anything to that effect, and I feel like that's a real pricey pickup.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that's you know, you start if you want Jonathan Drouin, you start with Pouliot in your discussion. And I don't know, and even though he hasn't had a great year in Wilkes-Barre, and maybe that's actually not a bad idea. That's a pretty big move. I don't know that's. Yeah, I don't know that's the kind of, you know, big splash that they want to make right now. I think it's more a matter of a more veteran guy. You know, that pending UFA guy for you know, to me, that's what I see. A couple of those rather than like a real organizational depth chart shattering type of move.
He hasn't proven yet he can play in the NHL, I guess, beyond a shadow of a doubt. But it sure sounds like scouts and GMs think he'll eventually be a top six, right? I mean,
yeah.
He requested the trade from Tampa.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, his skills are—he's just really skilled. And if you watch him at times, but I remember that exhibition game in Johnstown, just being really impressed with how quick he was and how talented he was. And then just—you don't see anything out of him. So it's kind of a—you know what? I mean, maybe am I talking about Drouin or Pouliot?
Yeah, Drouin. Yeah, well, yeah. But exactly.
You know what I mean?
You could use it for the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of similar players in that respect. So maybe I just found a perfect match.
He has a lefty shot. There is a report from Chris Nichols that more likely to trade him to the Western Conference for whatever reason. But, you know.
Yeah, because if he fulfills his potential, he'll be sticking it down their throats.
Yeah,
know,
exactly.
Four
you
times
see
a year.
That.
Yeah.
Thanks for the email, though, from Carl. You can email the show, sportstalk@tribweb.com. And actually, you read Chris from Latrobe's mind. Would you trade Pouliot for Drouin? You were
okay, but Chris. That's putting me on the spot rather than just sort of talking about it. Would I trade Pouliot for Drouin? I think I would. Yeah, I do.
Now,
how about you?
You'd have to play him right now, right? I mean, Drouin.
Yeah,
you take the shackles off, and I don't know how many games did he play last year with Tampa in their run. I guess he played some big minutes, right? He played.
Well, not in the playoffs.
He didn't play in the playoffs, right?
I don't think he did, yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think he got a lot of minutes.
He had 4 goals and 32 assists, does that sound right? He had a bunch of helpers.
Yeah. I think I would, just because I'm not. Pouliot is kind of, I mean, you're halfway into this season in the AHL, and he just got named AHL All-Star yesterday, so it's not like he's having some kind of a dreadful season. But one thing you have to do, this is something that Craig Patrick this was a weakness of Craig Patrick. You have to, you have to either play, if you're not sure if a prospect is going to pan out, you have to make that decision quickly, and then you have to move him while he still has value.
Right.
And if you don't, you end up with Chris Beach.
Oh, geez.
Who, you know, there was a time when Chris Beach could have been traded for an asset, and instead he just kind of played out the string in Wilkes-Barre, and then...
He was, Jarmo Jagr.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they could have moved him for something. Actually, all three of the Jagr prospects, Chris Beach, Michael Civic, and Ross Lipischek, they all fit this description.
Yeah.
You know, you have to act decisively. If you've decided that the guy's not going to be the man, then you move him while he still has value, or you commit to him being the man and just kind of letting him hang around for too long in the minors. And as his value slowly slips away, that's no way to do business.
Drouin did play in 6 playoff games last year, like average about 10 minutes a game. He was a -7 or something. He wasn't very good.
I don't know if it's
those numbers.
I mean, there are, you know, of course, there's rumors that he and Cooper don't get along. It makes me wonder if you can't get along with John Cooper. I mean, you know, everybody seems to, you know, really. Actually, that just occurred. Something just occurred to me. John Hines never liked John Cooper.
Huh.
Wonder if Jonathan Drouin and John Hines might be a good fit in New
Jersey.
Yeah, and they could
have loves company.
Anti-John Cooper faction out there.
Well, let's talk about the Crosby All-Star snub before we wrap up the show, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Were you surprised at all by it? Do you think the NHL should have overlooked numbers and just made an effort to get him on the team? Is it a flawed format? Should Letang have made it? What would you make of all that?
Well, first of all, you're not going to get any outrage out of me. I do not get outraged over All-Star games very, very often. Just not something I do.
It's a league showcase. He's the face of the league.
No, but I'm not going to disagree.
I'm trying.
I'm not going to disagree with what you just said. I'm just not going to be outraged about it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's an all-star game. So from a marketing perspective, for God's sake, yes, Sidney Crosby should be in it. Of course he could. And you could
he should have been in Johnstown too at the War Memorial. This has been a season of, you know.
There are people who say that, yes. People in Johnstown especially. But, I mean, it's almost like, I mean, Crosby has been so accommodating as the face of the league. Like, he does every interview and every appearance the league has asked him to do. You almost feel like they should just name him an all-star. But, on the other hand, they're doing him a favor, you know, like we said, because he didn't really like playing in all-star games anyway. There's a lot of layers to this. The other layer is that it would have made perfect sense to put Crosby in instead of Backstrom and John Carlson in instead of Letang. And then you still have your Capitals, proper Capitals representation for a team that's running away with the division lead. And you also, you know, work Crosby into the mix too. Yes. To answer your original question, yes, Sidney Crosby should be in the All-Star game because it's an All-Star game. You know, but I can see, let me ask you this. If that's the case, if you want to look at it that way, mm-hmm. Should you, you know, then what's the point of even looking at how guys are playing in a particular year? Like, could you just make it like, make yourself like, here's the example I'd use. Why don't you just make it like WrestleMania? Just get the most, pick the most entertaining matchups that you can think of.
WrestleMania's got more credibility.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, if John Scott's going to be the captain of the Pacific Division team, then maybe you make the captain of the Metropolitan Division team Dylan McElrath or something. And then, you know, we'll
Zach
see.
Zach Sill.
We'll see what happens. Or maybe you just get the most interesting players and put them in the All-Star game. You know what I mean? And so at some point,
well,
you have to
case,
draw a
Sid's
line.
Sid's got to be in there. I mean,
certainly.
Henrik Lundqvist would be in there. He gets snubbed up in New York.
Right. A very snappy dresser. You want to have him in there for those sorts of things. Yeah.
Zach Rinaldo in, you know.
Well, he would certainly, yeah, he's certainly interesting. I mean, you know, and that's what I'm saying. Like, do you want to go all out and make it into a we're here to entertain you event? Excuse me. And if that were the case, you know, playing 3-on-3, you might just try to get the fastest guys you could find, you know? You'd put Michael Grabner in the All-Star game, or you'd put Trevor Daley in the All-Star game, you know? Just because those guys would fly around 3-on-3. I guess you don't do that, because that creates its own silly scenarios. But
it's tough. You can only pick 6 forwards per division,
yeah.
So you're limited on how many forwards you can take. So that's why Uncle Leo Komarov's in, and, you know, God knows we all want to watch Leo Komarov in the All-Star game. But, you know, it's Toronto. I'm sure Toronto fans would rather watch him, you know, than they would Sid.
Well, you had to pick, yeah, somebody from the Leafs. So it's either Komarov or Van Riemsdyk, I guess. It's a tough choice. I know, yeah. Ian Cole would not pick Leo Komarov to be in the All-Star game.
Probably not.
He is not a fan of that guy at all. He was talking to him about it after the hit on Letang.
Well, yeah.
The boarding on Letang. Cole was... on the record, he was very critical of Leo Komarov. And then off the record, he was very profane when discussing Leo Komarov.
Wait, that was supposed to be off the record.
Well, it was the exact same point he made on the record, except he just used different words. You know what I'm saying?
A little more explicitly, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly.
The not safe for work version.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, give me your thumbnail sketch on the Diwa in our last couple minutes here.
Oh, yeah.
How they've performed lately, because Letang's been back in. He and Mata have been a big minute pairing. Have they been effective?
I think so. I mean, most of the time. You know, not every single game, but boy, they've had some games where they've really, like, put up huge possession numbers and looked really good together. I think the Daley acquisition has been good. I think Ian Cole is, in a lot of ways, a very important part of this D group, because right around the time of the coaching change, I thought he was playing very poorly. And I think he's been getting better since then, because they don't have any, you know, real honest to goodness physical defensemen. That's just not what they value. But among the 6 that they have, he's the one that can play with a little bit of an edge, a little bit of snarl. So that makes him really important. So, and Dumoulin has been a real pleasant surprise all year, really. I mean, I thought he'd struggle. I thought he'd be more inconsistent than he's been. He's been very consistent. And then if you look at it that way and consider Ben Lovejoy has his faults, but if he's going to be your 6th defenseman and you're going to give him 6th defenseman kind of minutes, which they haven't been because he's been paired with Dumoulin. But my point is that if Ben Lovejoy is your worst defenseman, you have a pretty good defense core. And, excuse me, I actually think that this defense group, there's a possibility with a little bit of improvement that they could sort of round into form. That maybe, like I said, maybe that winger is more important than the defenseman.
If they could get a top four, though, would Lovejoy bump down to a third pairing, and you'd have, you know, maybe a nice Dumoulin and player X as your shutdown pair, and you could upgrade that a little bit?
To me, yes. That's exactly what I'd do. I think the time has probably come to see what Dumoulin would do with, say, a Daly, just for instance. And then you'd have...
Even better if you could get a real thumper there with Dumoulin, like somebody that could control a game and play 25 minutes. I mean, I think Dumoulin would be really good in that situation.
And then your third pair is...
Yeah, Lovejoy and Cole, or, you know, Daly and Cole, whatever.
Right. Daly and Cole or Daly and Lovejoy. Yeah, I mean, to me, you're right. So get me a left shot winger and get me a top four defenseman, and we're good.
And by the way, Simone Dupre has been dealing with concussion symptoms still, right? He hasn't played like four games, so
he's missed.
As bad as the trade looked, that's
he's missed the majority of the season. Yeah, but Jim Rutherford doesn't get credit for that. It's not like he foresaw concussion issues.
That's true. You're
Dupre.
Right.
We're not going to let him off the hook. I might let him off the hook on Panarin, but I'm not letting him off the hook on Dupre.
Which is bizarre. You should not let him off the hook on Panarin. Can you imagine Crosby and Panarin right now? What kind of a duo that would be?
Ken, anybody could have had him. Literally anybody.
You got Malkin. I don't want to hear excuses. Get him to Cafe Pushkin, get Putin on the line, and get the deal done.
This idea that Malkin has some kind of magnetic pull over other Russians, I'm not exactly sure
where
this
is coming
from.
He's got a direct line to the president.
But so does Ovechkin. So does Tarasenko. Come on, you can't just... Be like, I'm go.
Ovechkin's old and over the hill. Gino's now. He Gino's it.
Hey, Gino, go get me a Russian.
That's the Pens Roundtable for this Friday, January 8th. Good stuff, JB. Good to have you back in the saddle here, and looking forward to the weekend. Montreal, and they're on the road for quite a bit here, so you guys will be traveling, huh?
Yeah, Bill's got Montreal, and then I've got that Southern Swing, the Raleigh and Tampa trip.
Okay. Raleigh's not so good, but you get made up for in Tampa, so.
Tampa in January. If I complain about that, there's something wrong with me.
Nothing to complain about. Mm-hmm. Have a good trip, and we'll talk to you next Friday.
Sounds good.
Pens Roundtable, every Friday from 1 to 2 on Trib Live Radio.